I want you to imagine with me for just a moment. Try to take yourself as well as you possibly can from what you know about the days when Jesus was walking upon this earth. Try to take yourself to that culture. You have to take away some automobiles. You'd have to take away cell phones, take away a lot of technology. Think about people walking around in sandals or bare feet instead of in shoes. Think about robes instead of suits and ties or jeans and a t-shirt. But try to think back and place yourself in the sandals of someone who had a little bit of interest, a little bit of curiosity about this man by the name of Jesus from Nazareth, the son of a carpenter. You've heard about how he'd been doing some magnificent things, things that were hard for you to actually believe someone could do, but so many people were talking about it. He fed 5,000 people with just a few loaves and a few fish. He turned water into wine. He was healing people who weren't able to see. He was healing people who weren't able to walk. Certainly you would be curious about this man. Jesus drew a number of curious people to him, crowds who followed him. And many of them, they really wanted to believe in Jesus. You look into John chapter 2 at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry. It was during the feast of the Passover. And there were many people there in Jerusalem who had come to believe in Jesus, but Jesus knew their heart. He knew that all they had evidently was an idle curiosity because he wasn't willing to entrust himself fully to them. There was a large crowd of people, though, wanting to follow after Jesus. Imagine what it was like after Jesus left Jerusalem a year before the last Passover. He went over to the side of the Sea of Galilee, went up onto a mountain with his apostles. And then he noticed a large crowd of people assembling to see him. Can you imagine being in that crowd yourself? Jesus then, looking upon that crowd and having compassion upon them because they didn't have anything to eat. They had been with him all day long. He turns to his apostles and he says, "You feed these people." And Philip, he was thinking, "Lord, it would be impossible for us to feed all of these people. It would take 8 months of a man's wage." But here comes Andrew with this little boy with his loaves and his fish. And Jesus begins breaking and blessing the food. And he tells the apostles to pass it out among all the people. The people were so amazed, they began to claim, "He is the prophet." And they wanted to make Jesus a king. Obviously, their curiosity had become great, even to the point where they said, "We'll make this man a king. Finally, we have someone who can lead us into victory over the Romans." That's when Jesus said no. He sent his apostles across the sea in a boat, and he went up onto a mountain to be able to pray and get away from the people for a little bit. Then when the time came about night, when nighttime came around, he snuck down off that mountain and began walking across the water to join his apostles. The next day, people hopped into their boats. Can you imagine being in their situation? They had just been fed by using a few loaves and a few fish. This man is the real deal. Certainly, you would get into a boat out of curiosity, travel across the Sea of Galilee just to be able to see this man again. Then you find him. "Where'd you go, Jesus? Why'd you come over here? How did you get over here?" Could you imagine Jesus looking at you and saying, "You're not following me because you saw the signs, but you're following me because you ate of the loaves and your bellies were full. Your curiosity was filled. Your interests were filled. But you're not following me," Jesus says, "for the right reasons." Can you imagine that? Jesus would go on to tell these people, "I told you before, you don't believe in me. Even though you've seen me, you still don't believe." Jesus talks about him being the bread that's come down from heaven. He says, I'm the bread of life. And they began to grumble among themselves. They began to dispute. He wants us to eat his flesh? How disgusting is that? Place yourself in their sandals. And imagine hearing Jesus telling you, you need to eat my flesh and drink my blood. How's that curiosity now? Everyone around you is grumbling. Everyone around you is disputing and thinking, what's he talking about? This is too hard. This is just too much. We learn at the close of John chapter 6, many of the disciples turned away and walked with him no more. You know, it's interesting that Jesus was the best at drawing people to himself. But he was also the best, it seems, at giving people a reason to want to walk away. Jesus could draw just about anybody to him, and they would come with curiosity. They would come with interest, but then Jesus would get down to the heart. And he would find out, are you just curious? Or are you really certain that this is what you want to do? Are you curious? Or are you certain? In Luke chapter 14, beginning in verse 25, we find Jesus. Once again, a crowd has begun to follow him. Great crowds accompanied him, and he turned and said to them, and everything that Jesus says from here down through verse 33 is all about them counting the cost. Jesus is within a year of going to the cross. He's dealt with crowds who have come to him before. With curiosity. He's allowed them to follow along with him. He's treated them to some food. He's treated them to some magnificent works of healing, and they were able to witness it. He's taught them. But now Jesus is ready to ask, are you sure that you've counted the cost? It's fine for you to follow along with me and listen to me and allow me to teach you. I want that, Jesus says. But it's time for you now to take a step beyond curiosity. Jesus says, I want you to be certain. Back in John chapter 6, Jesus looked over at Peter and the other apostles after all these other followers had walked away, and Jesus asked, he says, will you also walk away? And you talk about a benchmark of discipleship. You find it in John chapter 6. And verse 67, Peter said, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We believe and are sure or have come to know for certain that you are the Holy One of God. Thinking about your discipleship of Jesus, how would you describe it? Are you curious? See, that's not altogether a bad thing, but eventually we need to grow beyond curiosity. There may be some questions that we have, but eventually we have to say, I'm going to accept my understanding of this right now, and I'm going to move on it. I'm not going to be ever searching. I want to have faith and move on it. I want to be certain. What we find in Luke chapter 14, verse 26 down to verse 33, is Jesus giving us some things to think about, some things to consider. If our desire is truly to be a disciple of Jesus, we need to think about these things. Sometimes I wonder if maybe we're so eager to get someone into the waters of baptism that we never talk about the life that they're being immersed into. Jesus wants to make certain of this, that we know what being a disciple is all about. It's not just being a follower of Jesus. Yes, that's part of it. But it's also about abiding in His Word. It's about loving others. It's about bearing fruits of evangelism. But none of that even matters if we don't get this right. Jesus begins in verse 26. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Jesus says, unless you do this, you cannot have this. Unless you do this, you cannot become a disciple. Jesus said, it's impossible for you to be a true disciple of mine unless you do what? Jesus shocks the sensitivities of their minds and our minds. You need to hate your mama. You need to hate your daddy. You need to hate your brothers and your sister. You need to hate your husband or your wife. And yes, you even need to hate yourself. Now surely Jesus is talking in hyperbole here. And he's exaggerating things in order to make his point. But he's not. He's not. Jesus truly says, if you're going to be his disciple, you must hate your father, your mother, your wife, your children, your brothers, your sisters, and even yourself. But that doesn't make sense to us, does it? Because this is the same God who wants us to love even our enemies. And now he's saying we have to hate our friends, we have to hate our families, we have to hate ourselves. This is the God who wants us to have a love about our own selves. That we would seek out His ways, that we would seek out a relationship with Him, and He wants us to hate? How do we make any sense of this? I want us to think about it as a comparison. I don't want us to think about it, and I'm sure you've heard this before, as, well, what He really means is to love less. Well, that is implied here. But I want us to think about it perhaps a little bit differently. Perhaps Jesus was telling us that our love for God needs to be so magnificent. Our love for Him needs to be so great that in comparison, even the things that are special to us, even the people who are special to us, the things that we would normally say that we love, when compared to the love that we have for God, compared to the love that we have for Christ, it would appear as if we hate those things. Maybe these were some real words to the disciples back then. People who, in their culture, if they gave up their religious practice that they had followed or had been followed by their family, in their culture, it would have been as if they were saying to their family, I hate you. I hate my legacy. I hate my traditions. I'm going to follow something else. We see that even today in some cultures throughout the world. You find someone who becomes a Christian in a Muslim country, and they will be viewed as someone who hates their family, or they never would have done that. To follow Jesus would have been to give up so much. A couple of times in the Gospel of John, we find that anyone who confessed Jesus as Christ would be cast out of the synagogue. Jesus wants to diagnose your heart. Is your love for Jesus that great? Do you want Jesus to be one of many? Or do you want Him to be your one and only? One of many. Or your one and only. For us who might have this curiosity about following Jesus and this interest about following Jesus, maybe we think, you know, Jesus is pretty cool. This is awesome. All the things that He was able to do, all the things that He is able to do in my life even today, that's great. We might think that we're going to step into following Jesus and bring everything else right along with us. But Jesus doesn't want that. Jesus wants you. Sometimes we want to settle for Jesus being one of many instead of our one and only. Is your love for Jesus so great, so magnificent that if you lost your family, if you lost your friends, if you lost your job, if you lost everything, would you still follow Him? He doesn't want to be one of many. Jesus wants to be your one and only. That doesn't mean you can't have other interests in life. It doesn't mean you can't have hobbies or recreation or enjoy some other form of entertainment or education, but Jesus wants to be your one and only. When it came down to it, He would be followed. If you had a choice between following your family and following Jesus, you'd follow Jesus. If you had a choice between following your education or following Jesus, you would follow Jesus. If you had a choice between following your financial goals or following Jesus, you would follow Jesus. If you had a choice between following your friends or following Jesus, you would follow Jesus. He wants to be your one and only. We look further into our text this morning down in verse 27. Jesus wants us to investigate. He says, whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Bearing the cross. Jesus had told his disciples that he was going to Jerusalem, that he would suffer at the hands of men. They obviously knew that Jesus one day was going to die, even though they didn't want that. They knew it was going to happen. But I don't know that he had ever told them that it would be on a cross. And so why is Jesus bringing up all of this cross talk? You know, killing people by hanging them on a cross didn't begin with Jesus. The Romans had been doing this for a long, long time. Many Jews had witnessed their fellow countrymen, even some family members or friends or loved ones being crucified on a cross. So they knew what it was all about. It was the most horrifying way for a person to die. Not only that, but in their minds, cursed is any man who hangs on a tree. The worst possible way that a Jew could die would be hanged on a Roman cross. So what's Jesus talking about when he talks about bearing their own cross? Well, he's asking, are you willing to suffer persecution? Are you willing even to die? Are you willing to make the ultimate sacrifice? See, it's not a burden. It's a sacrifice. And sometimes we get those two things mixed up. Maybe we've experienced a loss. Maybe there's something terrible that's happened to us and continues to happen to us. And maybe we say, oh, well, that's my cross to bear. That's not a cross. Because a cross is a sacrifice. And a sacrifice is always voluntary. It's something that you choose to do. It's a choice to die to self in order to live for Jesus. And maybe there are times that we have said, I'm trying the best that I can. And I don't want to mock that. I don't want to ridicule that. But we need to realize something. Trying doesn't accomplish anything. Whenever you do it, that's where the accomplishment is. When we think about following Jesus, let's stop trying to follow Jesus and let's start dying to follow Him. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 31, Paul says, I die daily. He doesn't say, I try daily to follow Jesus. He says, I die daily. Jesus then begins to tell a couple of parables. He says it's time to do some evaluation. I want you to consider the cost. Verse 28, for which of you, desiring to build a tower, does not first sit down and count the cost, whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it will begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Jesus wants to know, do you really know what you're signing up for? Jesus had told his disciples once, the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. There were times when Jesus looked at his disciples and said, marvel not that the world hates you. That impressed John so much that he even recorded that in one of his epistles. Marvel not that the world hates you. Jesus said, if you want to be a disciple of mine, then you need to count the cost. You need to consider what you're getting into. According to the Apostle Peter, in 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 3 and 4, when we make this commitment, when we decide to follow Jesus, people will begin to think of us differently. How will they think of us? Well, Peter says, they'll think we're strange. They'll think we're weird. And they'll say some other things about us too. Maybe they'll call us old-fashioned. Maybe they'll call us behind the times or politically incorrect. They'll say, well, you're just hanging on to a bunch of ancient words written by an ancient people to an ancient people that have no relevance to us today. Those of us who are wiser and smarter and more in tune with things. In that very same chapter, in 1 Peter chapter 4, Peter acknowledged that you'll suffer as a Christian, but when you do, do it to glorify God. Have you really counted the cost of following Jesus? And that brings up a good question. When we think about our own commitment to following Jesus, do we just sort of pencil it in? Or do we sign up? We know what it means when we tell someone that we just want to be penciled in. It means we're going to give this sort of commitment to it. But if we can't work it out, then I'll just erase my name. How many of us do that with Jesus? Jesus, you're awesome. Jesus, you're incredible. This idea of following after you is great. Pencil me in. And we know what we can do then. When things get tough, when temptation comes about, we can erase our name until things smooth out again. We're ready to return to Jesus, and then we'll pencil our name right back in. I didn't really like what the Bible had to say about that. Erase my name. Oh, I like what it says over here. That helps me in my life. Pencil me back in. Maybe we're always ready, always sure that we sign up in lead and have our eraser handy. Are you penciled in? Are you signed up? Have you made a vow? Have you made a promise? Have you entered into a covenant with Jesus, penciled in or signed up? The next parable Jesus gives us is in verse 31. And it looks very similar to this first one, but there is a difference. Jesus wants us to consider. Or what king, going out to encounter another king in war, will not sit down first and deliberate whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? And if not, while the other is yet a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. You know, it almost looks as if Jesus has moved illustrations, but to try to get the same point across. If you're going to build a tower, you need to sit down and you need to try to budget it out and plan it and count the cost because you're in the process of building this relationship with Jesus. You need to count the cost of doing that. But now he says you're about to go to war. I realize there are many times that we look at the Christian life and we think that this is a war. I'm going into battle. I put on my Christian armor, right? The whole armor of God. Let me tell you something. I don't enter into the battlefield of the world to come to peace with the devil. I enter into the battlefield of the world so that I can be at peace with God. Jesus was talking about building a tower, and he said you need to count the cost of following him. He talks about being a king that sets out for battle and making peace with the foe. He says you need to count the cost of not following him. James 4, verse 4 tells us that if our friendship is with the world, we are at enmity with God. Would you be a friend of the world and at enmity with God? Or would you truly follow Jesus so that your movement can flow in harmony with God, so that you might be at peace with him, at enmity or at peace? Verse 33. So therefore, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. Question. Are you all in? Now we see this in sports from time to time, don't we? Are you all in? Are you ready to put everything you have into Jesus? It's a good question. A lot of times that's the way we think about it. We want to be all in Jesus. We want to take everything that we have and we're going to put it all into Jesus Christ. And we say, there you go, Jesus. I just gave you my all, everything there is about me. But is that what Jesus is talking about as he wants us to count the cost? I think normally that's how we think about it. Everything I have, everything that I'm about, I'm going to pour it all into Jesus. I'm all in. But that's not what Jesus was talking about, was it? Listen again to verse 33. Any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. So what is Jesus saying? Here you are, you've been curious. You've been interested in Jesus. You've made a decision to follow after him, for him to be in you and you to be in him. Here's the real question. Are you in, even if it costs you your all? This is what happens. It's kind of like a strainer. And as we pour ourselves into Jesus, Jesus will catch everything that he wants. And everything that doesn't matter will be strained out. It's going to be filtered out. Jesus wants all of your energy. He wants all of your time. He wants everything that you can give him. But there are some things that he doesn't want in the relationship. The things that can draw you away from it. The things that can keep you from being a true servant. The things that are insignificant. The real question isn't, are you all in? The real question is, are you in? Even if it costs you your all. Are we curious or committed? Are we trying or are we dying? Are we penciled in or signed up? Are we at enmity or are we at peace? Are you in? Even if it costs you your all. Think about those questions this morning. If you're ready to be all in, no matter what it costs you, the Lord is inviting you to come this morning. Accept His invitation by turning away from sin, by confessing your faith that Jesus is the only begotten Son of God, by allowing yourself to be immersed in water, to have your sins washed away. Begin following Him. If you're already a Christian, but you're struggling with some sin in your life, accept the Lord's invitation by repenting of your sins, asking for prayers, asking for forgiveness. Come this morning, we'll pray for you. The Lord will forgive you. Whether it's for baptism or for restoration, the Lord is inviting you right now. Please come as we stand and sing together.